This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative Party Britain Chris Patten has had the kind of globe-straddling career that few public figures pull off anymore, spanning continents and remarkable moments in history. He was the last British governor of Hong Kong, an outspoken conservative cabinet member in London, a top official in the European Union. He's now Chancellor of Oxford University and carries easily the sadly old-fashioned title statesman. Chris Patten grew up in the American century and was glad for it. Now he's not so sure. The American Republic has, he worries, become an empire, and the West itself may be in trouble. Up next on Point, super statesman Chris Patten and the fate of the West. Joining me now in the studio is Chris Patten. From 1999 to 2004, he was the European Commissioner for External Relations. He was former Member of Parliament for Bath. He's author of East and West, China, Power and the Future of Asia. His new book is Cousins and Strangers, America, Britain, and Europe in a New Century. Chris Patten, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. So place yourself, for those of us who do not know Chris Patten, you're in the Conservative Party. You're not at the most conservative end of it, but you say, I am a conservative. Before we get into the world and America and Europe and all the rest, what are your politics?
I'm a moderate conservative. I'm where the Conservative Party used to be, and I hope will be again, when it used to be the natural party of government in the UK. I believe in markets. I believe in fiscal prudence. I believe in a state which is effective but is no larger than it needs to be. I believe in devolving power, in internationalism, in free trade. I'm socially liberal. I don't like the idea of a policeman under every bed. I'm in favor of free speech. So I guess it's somebody who's a liberal Democrat, but liberal in the traditional philosophical sense of the word, and somebody who doesn't believe in isms, who doesn't believe that there are simple ideological solutions to the world's problems.
So there you've been sitting, most recently in Tony Blair time, sitting in the EU, watching things kind of come apart in the U.S.-Europe relationship, especially since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the war in Iraq. And here you've got Cousins and Strangers as the new book. How serious is the problem? How deep the estrangement? How consequential?
Well, I don't think, to borrow a cliche from political columns rather than geologists, I don't think we've seen a shifting of the tectonic plates under the Atlantic. But I do think that we've seen in the last few years a revolution in the way that some in power see America's role in global leadership. I think there is obviously an intellectual argument between a more traditional approach to foreign policy, let alone the Democrats' approach, and what we've seen with the neocons and the assertive nationalists. And I think myself that this is an argument in which the rest of the world has an interest. I remember Secretary Baker, when he was the Secretary of State, saying about the Balkans that America shouldn't be involved because it didn't have a dog in the fight. Well, it's certainly the case that the rest of the world has a dog in the fight, the intellectual fight between the traditionalists in America and those who want to throw over a world order, which has done America very, very well and done the rest of us superbly well, too.
You write about exactly that in the American century, as it's often called in this country, at least the last part of the 20th century, America supporting that internationalist view, being a central architect of many of those institutions at the UN and right on around, and now kind of turning on those. I'd love it if you'd give us a flavor of your book, Chris Patten, maybe a bit of a reading there from early on in the book, where you talk about this evolution in the way America looks at the world looks at the United States. Could you set it up and give us a bit of a reading there?
Sure. It was America that taught us to share sovereignty, both on our own continent and beyond. We are all Wilsonians now. But is America? Cut through all the arguments about Iraq, the Middle East, Iran and Afghanistan, the role of the UN, global democracy, proliferation of terrible munitions, terrorism, environmental hazard. Is not the real thing we need to know simply this? Does America still believe in the world it created, the world it encouraged and led the rest of us, to our vast benefit, to accept? Has the great republic which ruled our hearts and destinies, with such accomplished imperial ease, partly because it eschewed the prerogatives of the emperor, now risked its safety and its standing today by claiming for itself imperial rights. Augustus and the wisest of his successors preserved their inheritance and guarded the boundaries of Rome's empire by exercising restraint. Edward Gibbon's Great History tells what happened when later emperors forgot that lesson. So under American tutelage, we in Europe turned our back on the bellicose nationalist politics of the 19th and early 20th centuries, and through our new modes of cooperation, imperfect, sometimes clumsy, even vainglorious, are bent on coping with the problems of the 21st. Meanwhile, America seems intent on going back to the politics of the century we were previously urged to abandon, back to the gunslinging Theodore Roosevelt, but with precision-guided missiles. Is that past to be all our futures? Or can we, even now, by greater European exertion, help to avoid it and save our great friend from itself?
Chris Patton, reading from his new book, Cousins and Strangers, America, Britain, and Europe in a New Century. He has served all over the world, got a big view on things. And I was fascinated by your description, Chris Patton, of how you saw American global power as a young man and how you see it now.
I got into politics in the United States. I was a student. I was over here, and I got involved in a campaign working for John Lindsay. So America formed me. In his mayoral campaign, I'm 102, back in 1965. But the first thing I'd remembered politically wasn't that. The first thing I'd remembered as a young man, the first international event, was the Suez invasion. Mm-hmm. Was when Britain and France tried to take out Colonel Nasser, take over the Suez Canal. They regarded Nasser as a sort of Asiatic Mussolini and thought that they should learn from the lessons of Munich. My God, how many mistakes have been made by people who said that.
And America stepping in a new way.
And America stepped in through the UN, stepped in by threatening to bankrupt Britain in order to stop the invasion of an Arab country by two European countries, arguing, this is what Ike said and what John Foster Dulles said, that it would be appalling for the image of the West in the Arab world. Now, as the French would say, autre temps, autre mœurs, other times, other ways of doing things. But it was the first example of America actually using the UN in order to stop the old imperial powers acting in a sort of colonialist gunboat way.
Mm-hmm. And fast forward here. Empire in here. And yeah, what do you mean by
well,
that?
Well, you then fast forward to, I'm afraid, Iraq. I mean, I don't want to get too involved, unless you want me to, in all those arguments. I totally accept that we all now are faced with the consequences, whatever we thought at the time.
But you call it the calamitous military invasion of Iraq, and then used the word empire so casually, I was struck by it. There's not even a qualifier. It's as if everyone would just accept that there's an American empire. I'm not sure that a lot of Americans would so easily swallow that
idea. I don't think that America is, in its guts, an imperial power like those in the 19th century. You don't, for example, train an imperial caste. You don't export people. You, on the whole, import people. There is no imperial power, even though some people would like you to have an empire.
Then we've got a lot of people abroad and armed right now.
Yeah, exactly. But the point I'm making is that even though you've had, as it were, a cultural predominance in the world and a military predominance, you've never in the past insisted on simply throwing your weight around and ignoring other people's opinions, or at least have never done it to the extent that the neoconservatives and the assertive nationalists suggest today. And what I regard as bizarre is that a system which has done you so well should be casually overthrown by some people in the name of conservatism.
That system, you mean international institutions?
Absolutely.
The UN?
Absolutely. What those international institutions have done, what that partnership has done, has been to legitimize your power and to protect you from the envy and fear of the rest of the world. And it is, I think, extraordinary to simply ignore that and put it on one side.
But the neocons say, look, they've reached the end of their effectiveness. They're actually just become talking shops that disguise problems, that nurture delusion more than they solve them. We've got to cut through the clutter here.
Well, I totally accept that the UN is imperfect, and it's largely imperfect because we haven't worked together to reform it in sensible ways. But when you look at the problems that crowd in on the international agenda, it's more and more obvious that no nation state on its own, not even one as mighty as the United States, can cope on its own. How can an individual country deal with, we see now, nuclear proliferation? With environmental disaster, with epidemic disease, with organized crime, with drugs. You actually need to work with others. And the more you can do that in ways which legitimize force, because force will occasionally be necessary, in my judgment, the better.
We're talking with celebrated British statesman Chris Patton. Brad is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi, sir. I would like to ask whether or not our new friends, I guess, China and India, coming up to being a world power, do you think they're going to need to turn over America in the old ways with munitions and guns and fighting, or are they just simply going to be able to come to a new understanding as a world power?
I think, and I feel this passionately, that it's wrong to regard the economic rise of Asia, of India and China as a threat to the United States. I don't see how hundreds of millions of people becoming better off, producing or providing a market for our own exports and products, selling to us at knockdown prices, is bad for us. I don't think that China, which is obviously a more significant military player than India, is ever going to rival the United States in terms of military technology. It has a budget which is about a quarter of America's on military spending, about an eighth of Europe's. What I do think is that we have to work with India and China, because most of the problems we face on the world stage are not going to be soluble unless we can work with these two great countries. And I also think that while where some people have seen this century as it were, belonging to America, maybe the 19th belonging to Britain, they see the 21st century, I should have said 20th century earlier, they see the 21st century as being a struggle between American hegemony and China. I just think that's an incredibly old-fashioned way of looking at the world, and the world and the next century is actually going to be a struggle of ideas, ideas with which America has always been associated, capitalism, participative democracy, the rule of law. If we play things right, we should certainly avoid military struggles in the next few years, for example, like the wars between the industrial societies, the wars between nation states that we saw in the 19th and 20th centuries.
So to Brad's question, you don't see necessarily military conflict here. You certainly don't welcome it. But you've got a kind of unique perch from which to look at this with all your time in Asia, your time in Europe. You describe the West, if we can still use that term, as dysfunctional in many ways in this book. Leave aside military power for a moment, just dynamism and surge at work here. What is it? Maybe for 1,000 years, the West has kind of been the dynamic power on this planet. Do you see the possibility of that changing? Can you imagine 100, 200 years out, China, India, the East as the dominant kind of tune setter for the planet? Or is that old-fashioned thinking, as you put it? Is it a blended future?
Well, I think that it actually slightly misunderstands the past. Until 1820, I'm sorry to shower you with statistics, but until 1820, India and China represented over 50% of the world's wealth. That had fallen to 8% by the 1950s, 1960s. And what we're now seeing really is a recovery by India and China, which after all have, 2.5 billion people, with the Indian population due to exceed the Chinese by the middle of the century. For 18 out of the last 20 centuries, China has been the biggest economy in the world, and it will be the biggest economy again in this century. But it's not going to be as rich as America, and it's not going to be as rich as Europe, because in per capita terms, it will be well behind, dividing the total wealth by the number of people, and because China will get old before it gets that rich. It's got an aging population, unlike India, which has a much younger age profile.
Well, let me just ask on that, though. You say you point back to 1820 and say China and India put them together, that they were wealthier than the West. I'll grant that. But when you look at the dynamism, you look at the ideas that were brewing in the Renaissance. Look at the age of exploration and who was doing most of it. I mean, we learned more about Chinese sailors as well recently, but still.
But the only reason why the Chinese didn't discover America, with great respect, is because the eunuchs in the Ming court in the 15th century stopped the explorations by those great Chinese fleets. Chinese fleets, which were hugely bigger in the 15th century than the Spanish armada in the 16th. And China turned in on itself in the 15th century, and we were all the victims of that, or some of us in Europe were the beneficiaries, because we made the discoveries of markets as well as land and territory rather than the Chinese.
Another bit of dynamism there. Great countries can turn in on themselves. Yeah. I mean, I think the question stands whether the kind of cultural and dynamism envelope of this planet is set for a shift.
Well, two things. First of all, it is easier to stay rich than to get rich if you're poor. There's a wonderful Asian expression. I think it's one of those many, maybe real or maybe made up Chinese sayings, that if you've got a choice, it's better to join a short queue rather than a long queue.
Yes, indeed.
So it's going to be very difficult for other people to catch up with where we are. But having said that, I'm now very involved in higher education and research. And I think you see in the scholarly dynamism of India and China, particularly a threat to Europe, not so much to America, because you're spending so much more than we are in Europe on research and development and higher education. But I guess if you look at the number of scientific papers written at American universities by young Chinese and Indian software engineers, scientists in general, you get the picture. I think that it's a cliche, which isn't wholly true, that knowledge is going to be the basis of future economic growth. I mean, ignorance has never been a basis for growth. Mm. I think we sometimes exaggerate that the point. But nevertheless, if our education systems stagnate while the Indians and Chinese commit themselves much more to the pursuit of knowledge, then sooner or later there will be economic consequences. It won't just be cheap bras and underpants that the Chinese are selling us. It'll be high technology.
And in some corners, already is. We're talking with Chris Patton, former chairman of the Conservative Party in the UK. Robert's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would like to take exception to the author's assessment of America's relationship with the rest of the world. Just because we act in what we consider our best interest when the other countries of the world and institutions, and I refer to the UN and the EU, don't take that position, I don't consider that bullying. I certainly don't consider our action in the Middle East to be a bullying action or an action of us throwing our weight around.
Robert, we've got it. There it is, Chris Patton. This is a widely held attitude in this country. You've got ineffectual international institutions. The U.S. has to look after its interests. What do you say?
What I say is that alongside hard power for the last 50 years, America has deployed spectacularly successfully soft power. That is, people have thought that the sort of society they would like to have for themselves is very like America. They've identified with American values and so on. One of the problems of the last few years, and you see it in all the work by the Pew Research Center on attitudes to America around the world, is that even in some of those countries which are best disposed to America, which are traditional American friends, even in some of those countries, you see growing criticism of the United States and the sense, which may have as much to do with rhetoric as it does to do with what actually happens on the ground, the sense that America doesn't really care about working with partners and doesn't care about the international rule of law, which America, more than anybody else, put in place. When you have an argument in the United States involving, for example, the vice president about whether it's right to torture people, you shouldn't be surprised if that has an impact on an opinion around the world. Opinion in countries which have always regarded the United States as the absolute paradigm of how to safeguard civil liberties under the rule of law.
So what do you say to Robert, saying, Robert says, we have to look after our self-interest. It's a big, complicated, competitive world. What do you want from us, Chris Patton? What's your response?
Well, I think I'm right in saying that there is no shortage of debate in the United States about whether the way that you've handled the Middle East, whether the way that you've handled Iraq is actually in your best interest, whether, for example, Iraq has increased the dangers in the world or decreased them. It feels to the rest of us awfully like increasing the dangers and potential dangers from terrorism rather than reducing them.
You're a conservative, but you're very tough on the neo-conservatives.
Yes, because I don't think they're conservative. Usually when the word neo is attached to a noun, it means non rather than rather than the real thing. So neo-intellectuals don't usually read books. Neo-liberals are usually deeply illiberal. And I think the neo-conservatives are not remotely conservatives because they want to upset and turn over the world order.
You say neocons, neoconservatives want permanent revolution, neocon revolution. They want at least permanent war. At least permanent war? Is that really what you see coming out of that camp in Washington?
It's what one or two have said, like Max Boot. I mean, I've got quotes from some of them in my book.
You quote him saying, looking forward to a new era where America, like the British Empire, will always be fighting some war somewhere against someone.
Can that really be what Americans want? I simply don't believe it. There are others who say that we should regard Iraq as like the Normandy beaches in the Third World War. This is not sensible talking. This isn't what you would have heard from George C. Marshall or Harry Truman or Dean Acheson or President Kennedy. This is not a very sensible way of expressing American leadership.
And yet you write of in the international institutions that Robert refers to, you say, look at the dreary, unreadable declarations, the maelstrom of self-interested humbug masquerading as high principle, the dismally repellent philanthropy and international do-goodery. You describe yourself in a conversation with John Bolton, himself a neocon, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., where you were opining that there was a need for sticks and carrots with Iran in the nuclear standoff, I guess. John Bolton replied to you, I don't do carrots. Does that work?
No, it doesn't. And I think we see that with Iran now. I think that Iranian ambitions to become a military nuclear power are something which we have to contest in the region. It's profoundly against the interests of the world. It's profoundly against our interests in Europe and yours in America. But how do you best achieve your objective? I think it was a mistake on our part after the reformist, more moderate Hatemi administration had been elected
in
Tehran for us not to have engaged with them and given them some of the face which they perhaps required in order to demonstrate to the hardliners that it was possible to do business with the West. So I think we lost an opportunity there by thinking of Iran entirely in terms of sticks rather than occasional carrots. I'm not a wimp, I'm not a softy, but I do think that sensible diplomacy involves the promise of improvement in relations and not just always the threat of force.
But I think Washington, the kind of one view out of there from the administration would be, look, the United States has been wanting to get tough for a long time. The U.S. sat back and said, Europe, have your go. Try and work it out with Iran. And from all news reports, that has apparently utterly failed.
I'm not sure that anybody has ever suggested a better approach. I'm not sure that the administration has been arguing, well, some idiots have been, you know, Tehran is the next step. The real guys, the testosterone guys, think that Iraq was the easy bit and now we want to take out Iran.
Does that extend to our UN ambassador?
I don't know. I don't think he is that foolish. I hope he's not, because it would make the world even more dangerous than it is already.
Mm-hmm.
There is a serious issue here in how we police the non-proliferation treaty. And if we are to mobilize consent and agreement around the international community for taking tough action against countries which breach the treaty, then we have to recognise the N8, the countries which have nuclear weapons, that we've got to do more ourselves to implement the treaty, like, for example, eschewing any further expenditure on research and development on nuclear weapons.
Which the US is not doing. Beth is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, I am liberal-minded. I'm friendly with lots of conservative British people, and I studied at Oxford. I agree with your guest that America is looking bad to the rest of the world. I am horrified about it. However,
yep.
The fact is 9/11 really did happen to America, and all my good friends at Oxford didn't call me. Only one of them called me, and my husband was leaving from New York that day.
Do you think they did not understand the gravity of what happened? I mean, they did look on.
Yeah, the gravity, and I think that the impact made everyone crazy. Here in Sudbury, people usually liberal-minded were, you know, they had to put police near a mosque. I mean, it was crazy, and it was because before all the great wars that unfortunately Americans aren't good enough historically remembering, we thought, oh my gosh, there hasn't been war on our land.
But Beth, does that leave you then in the more unilateralist camp? Are you saying that means America has to pull up the drawbridge and do its own thing or not?
I do not. And so I love this discussion because I want Mr. Patton to help us figure out, is it because it's the quote-unquote neoconservatives? Is it because it's the Republicans? Is it because it's Dick Cheney? I don't know.
Chris Patton, our caller, Beth, saying, hey, 9/11 happened. It was huge. It still clangs in the minds of Americans. How do you see it? What did it mean? And what do you make of its aftermath?
9/11 was uniquely dreadful. And it is not in any sense to misunderstand that, to underestimate what happened, for Europeans to point out from time to time that it's not the first terrorist atrocity. Two of my friends were murdered by Irish terrorists. We've seen in the United Kingdom until the George Mitchell brokered agreement, which I subsequently played some part in, we've seen 3,000 people killed by terrorists over a long period. Mm. But while we have experience with ETA, with other terrorists in Europe, 9/11 was a uniquely appalling event. What it doesn't do is, first of all, explain why Iraq was relevant. There used to be arguments that there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Nobody makes that point anymore. Mm. There was, of course, a connection between Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan, and there was no opposition at all in Europe to taking out the Taliban in Afghanistan, though it's fair to say that we helped to create the Taliban in the first place. What we do have to do is to find the roots of terrorism. And it's not like fighting a conventional war. Terrorism is going to be with us, I'm afraid, for years to come. And we have to understand why people commit these atrocities. And trying to understand and deal with those reasons is not the same as appeasement. It's not giving moral equivalence to terrorists. It's the smart thing to do, using our soft power, your soft power, as well as hard power. Let me give you an example which anybody in Boston, anybody in parts of the United States which have large Irish populations would understand. We could never have defeated terrorism by both the Protestant paramilitaries and by the IRA in Northern Ireland if we hadn't worked with the Dublin government and if we hadn't offered a political prospect, a political infrastructure in which people could put aside guns and bombs and actually try to work together through the democratic process.
What do you mean by that? I mean, the president said in the State of the Union speech, essentially, we're at war with radical Islam. Are you saying, Mr. President, you have to hold out an olive branch or a path toward cooperation with radical Islam?
No, what I'm saying is that we have to try to understand what motivates radical Islam and to distinguish between political Islam, between missionary Islam, and between jihadist Islam, which is causing so much appalling damage throughout the Middle East and has done so in London last summer, as well as to a much greater extent in the United States, in both Washington and New York.
How's that process of reaching out along all those vectors going? How's the Iraq war playing out in that dynamic globally in the U.S. and the U.K.?
Well, I don't think you could hand on heart say that the Iraq war had reduced the number of terrorists around. I think it's been both a magnet for terrorism and a production line for terrorists. What we have to try to understand, fathom out, it's not a question of Islam being coterminous with terrorism. 900 million out of the 1.2 billion Muslims around the world live in Asia, live in predominantly in societies which are democratic. Nor can you say that the other 300 million in the Middle East are disposed towards terrorism. They actually largely share Western values when you look at the surveys are done, but they don't like our policies. We have to try to understand why what seems to us to be globalization, increasing economic opportunity, opening up societies, is seen by a lot of people as licentiousness, as greed, as a new form of colonialism.
But are those policies or principles being exercised there?
Well, I think that to some extent it's our policies which make people misunderstand when we talk about spreading democracy or spreading capitalism. And they, I'm afraid, look at Iraq and they look at some of the other things that we've done in the Middle East.
Should we not be spreading democracy or capitalism?
Of course, but it's not like making instant coffee. It's not... if you're going to spread democracy, if that's the objective of foreign policy, then you've got to be consistent about it and clear about it. You can't be in favor of spreading democracy in West Asia, but not in Central Asia. You can't be in favor of democracy in
And you write
in
at
Iraq
some length about the
in...
Central Asian dictatorships at the U.S.
And what about Pakistan? What about Pakistan? We argue, well, it's real politics, you know. Musharraf may be a general rather than an elected leader, but he's our general. He's on our side. I think that's the way we create problems for ourselves. What we should be doing in Pakistan isn't providing F-16s for the Pakistani Air Force. We should be providing money for decent schools so that there aren't as many kids going to madrasas.
Chris Patton, former chairman of the Conservative Party in the UK, a voice of the UK, a voice maybe of Europe. Ralph is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
All right. Thank you, sir. Pleasure to speak to both of you gentlemen, and I would like to tell you that, sir, I am very proud of what you are saying about this country. First of all, just a quick background. My father served as a combat infantryman in both the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
He is highly decorated, Silver Star, Bronze Star, etc. He and I are both very ashamed of this country right now. The Bush administration has lost touch with reality and with the rest of the world. You know, the Europeans were our allies. They stood toe-to-toe to us after September 11. And, you know, and I agree with you, we had every right to go into Afghanistan. What we're doing in Iraq is I have absolutely no clue. But the main thing is America needs to realize that we're not alone in this war against terrorism, and that I do not understand any of the policies that the Bush administration is setting forth. And I love America, but I am ashamed to be an American right now, thanks to who we have in the White House.
Ralph, it's a broad brush you've got going there, but let us look at the picture you're painting, particularly about the relationship with Europe, Chris Patton. This was, for many years, for decades, called the indispensable partnership.
Yeah.
What's its health?
Well, first of all, I do think it's indispensable. I do think that the rest of the world needs the partnership to be in good condition. Most of the things that we want to do as Europeans, we can only achieve if we work with America. It's almost as true the other way round, and it's something we should remember, whether we're talking about economics or politics or the promotion of democracy. I speak as somebody who loves this country, who thinks that the transatlantic alliance is enormously important, who thinks that it's often been weakened by the way we behave in Europe, because we give the impression that we want to be rivals, not partners. That's completely absurd. We're very often patronizing, condescending, and that's lamentable as well. But having said all that, it is going to take a real commitment by American political leadership to a more traditional approach to foreign policy, just as it's going to take a commitment on the part of Europe to try to give the America the benefit of the doubt and to try to find ways in which we can be a strong and effective partner, not simply a Monday morning quarterback.
So continue on that self-critical line. If America is going to get lined up with Europe again, what does Europe need to do?
Well, the most effective foreign policy we've pursued in Europe, which has stabilized our own neighborhood, is to offer countries membership of the European Union, provided they introduce the sort of reforms which made Europe after the war, with an American security shield, so prosperous. So when Spain and Portugal and Greece shook off fascist authoritarian governments, we offered them membership of the European Union, so that when the Russian Empire in Europe collapsed, we offered countries from the Baltic to the Black Sea membership of the European Union. We've got to complete that process with the Balkans, with, in my view, Ukraine and Moldova, and then with Turkey.
And how does that leave the U.S. and Europe in sweet harmony again, expanding the EU?
Well, what it actually does is to stabilize a large region of the world so that America, which matters everywhere, doesn't have to bother about security there. Europe matters in some parts of the world. It matters in the Middle East. It matters in Africa. It matters in our own borders. It doesn't matter in the sense that China does in North Korea. America, because it's the only global heavyweight, because it's the only superpower, militarily and other ways, has to look to partners in different parts of the world. And Europe has to be an effective and not simply a sniping partner of the United States. But it does mean that America has to recognize that if we're partners, we're entitled to have opinions of our own occasionally.
And what's at stake here if this indispensable partnership continues to deteriorate, if the alienation goes on, if these two even drift off in very different directions? What's at stake? What's at risk?
Well, I think for America, what is at risk is losing the support of somebody who should be able to help you a bit with the heavy lifting. And that's why I very much hope that the slight change of tone we've seen, I think, since the U.S. and Britain and others got bogged down in what Winston Churchill called the thankless deserts of Mesopotamia. I hope that that slight change of tone will move into areas like the way we handle the Iran problem, the way we complete, I hope, the job in Afghanistan, the way we complete the work that we've done together in the Balkans, and I would like to see it going on to agreement on issues like the future of the environment.
And if it doesn't, if this relationship is not repaired?
If the relationship isn't repaired, then it's going to be damaging for Europe, damaging for America, and damaging for the whole world.
Damaging is such a broad word, but put some flesh on that. What do you mean?
Well, we'll be less prosperous and less peaceful. Take one very good example. Take the attempt to continue to open markets for the world's agricultural produce, industrial goods and services. It's fundamentally in Europe and America's interest to get a really strong agreement out of the Doha trade round. Mm-hmm. We in Europe have to do more on agriculture opening up our markets. You've got to do some more as well. But if Europe and America don't work together, we won't get an agreement, and we'll actually, in the future, lose some of the economic growth which we would otherwise have.
Barbara's calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a political science major from Democratic Minnesota. I worked for a Republican senator for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But now I look at the world as a mother with children, and I am quite concerned about how we are perceived in the world, but I'm wondering why there's always a natural shift in power. History supports that.
It's always moving somewhere.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Why is this different? Why should we be surprised? And what should we do about it? And as a mother who's bringing her children to Oxford this spring, does he have any recommendation on highlights we should see?
Well, there's the long and the short of it. The great.
Well, have a great time in Oxford. It's a really beautiful city with some of the best architecture in Europe. It's a real temple of education and the humanities, and I'm really proud of being associated with it. And
the Chancellor speaks.
The Chancellor speaks, exactly.
Yeah. But
on your earlier question about how America gets over its real values to the rest of the world, I think that that's very often inevitably associated not just with what is said, but what is actually done. I think America is enormously generous-hearted, and it does really represent the sort of values which others want to see. But beyond that, I don't think America is going to see its global leadership dissipated, or I don't think it's going to see its global leadership move elsewhere, because you're still the greatest military superpower. You're still the biggest cultural power in the world, with spectacular investments in innovation, in knowledge, in pushing back the frontiers of learning. And that, I think, is going to mean that for the foreseeable future, whether you like it or not, you're the biggest kid on the block.
So when George Bush says, and you quote him, 2002, at some point we may be the only ones left. That's okay with me. We are America. Are you lining up with that when you say it's going to be American power?
No, I'm lining up in saying that, of course, America is going to be the only superpower. But when a great American city is consumed in the floods, partly, I guess, because of the change in the global climate, when you read evidence from a lot of scientists that we may have moved beyond the tipping point in global warming and climate change, when you see the threat of avian flu just over the horizon, when you try to deal with HIV/AIDS, you know that it's not enough to be America and to be a superpower. You need an awful lot of other peoples to work with, and you need other international organizations like the World Health Organization or the World Environment Program or the Bretton Woods Institutions, the World Bank, IMF, UN. You need others to work with you in order to ensure that Americans can enjoy continue to enjoy living in this wonderful, magnificent country.
In a word, our time is very short. Do the neocons in Washington open their door, their ears, to you, Chris Patton?
I don't think so. I think, to be fair to them, they're up for argument. And one of the reasons why they've, I think, won their way on the agenda to a considerable extent in the United States is because they're much more vigorous in arguing their case. One thing I wanted to do was to argue back, and I hope other Europeans and, above all, other Americans will too.
Chris Patton, former chairman of the Conservative Party in the UK, the last British governor of Hong Kong. His new book is Cousins and Strangers, America, Britain, and Europe in a New Century. Mr. Patton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.